Sandy and Scott.
Plays balls out every time.
Oh, my God.
Crew, Sandy and Scott.
Wait a minute. Don't run this jive by us.
Crew, Sandy and Scott.
It was like I was a genius. Oh, I didn't
know. This is Drew, Sandy, and Scott.
So you, my friend, are on crack.
So, yeah, it's probably, I don't know if it's a cliche, maybe you could say it's a bad excuse, I agree.
Here's Drew, Sandy, and Scott.
Our third and final hour, and frankly, as Drew, Sandy, and Scott continue on Denver Sports Station, Sports Radio 104.3 The Fan, your home for the best live and local coverage. Broncos in the NFL. When I spoke to Dr. Perea a few weeks back about when he next might appear with us, Scott,
right,
said, why not on our first unofficially official Football Friday of 2014?
Because, you know, he used to play football. He's getting ready
15.
Right now.
Yeah.
Do you still get a little anxious at this time of year, even though it's been so many years?
Yeah, absolutely, man. I totally get fired up and excited, ready to go. There's nothing like football. You know, it's a game that teaches skills, life skills that, in my opinion, a lot of games can teach it, but not to the level football is. Football is just it's a challenge of our intestinal fortitude, our cognitive processing, really the whole gamut, the whole emotional side as well. So to answer your question, man, I'm fired up and ready to go.
And I know training, I just asked you a question because when you said that to me, made me think about it because we're getting ready. A week from Thursday, like yesterday, they'll be in full mode. They're going. And I know football's changed just like basketball changed. It's a full-year job now. I mean, it really is, or at least 11 of the 12 months. You mean, hey, take your 4 weeks, whatever.
Yep.
But it's a full-year job. We used to go to training camp to get into shape, probably still in 82 when you were doing you went to camp to get into shape.
Right.
That's what you did. It's not like that anymore. I was going to say mentally, though, because it still becomes a grind. As much conditioning as you are, you're still going two times a day. You're still going through all the meetings. You got to try to sneak in your weights. You got to try to sneak in your food, fuel.
Sure.
You got to sneak in your rest. I would still say the training camps are as much of an anxious time for guys, and you always say that the checkup from the neck up. I would almost think that it was as important in training camp as maybe even during the regular season once you've settled into that routine.
Oh, yeah. I think training camp is mostly a mental test. You know, guys will talk about, well, it's a lot of work. We run. We do a lot of physical stuff. But, you know, mentally, it's a big, big tax on the mind. You think about
Camp for the military.
Yeah, you think about the stress that's involved with, I mean, some of these guys, you know, obviously the veterans who have the bigger contracts, they know they're going to be around. But for a lot of these guys who are trying to make the team, there's a lot of mental stress. Every day they're reading into people's nonverbal communication, verbal communication. Do they like me? Am I going to get more reps tomorrow? If I'm not getting reps, does that mean they like me and they're just saving me? Or if I don't get reps, I'm not even getting a chance to show myself. So the game has become even more mental, Scott and Sandy, in my opinion. There's more of a mental test today than there's ever been because there's so much emphasized on the physical side of OTAs and the meetings. But the mental side of the game, I'm telling you, is where we separate the great from the good players.
Dr. Rick Perea, of course, in studio with us for the entire hour, professor of sports psychology. We'll get into that designation because I'm not sure you're thrilled with it exactly in a little while. Metro State University of Colorado and a member of the Denver Bronco preseason roster 31 years ago. What was that camp experience like for you? What stands out as you look back on it in terms of what you were just talking about, the mental versus the physical pressure, strain, what have you?
Right. You know, that's a great question, Sandy, because for me, it wasn't the physical battle that was the biggest test for me. It was the mental piece. You know, you're very fond of the Eagles. I know that. And the Eagles have a song that says, don't let the sound of your own wheels make you crazy. And that's what I did. I let the sound of my own wheels make me crazy. I was great in practice. In practice, I played weak outside linebacker. We called it the Wanda backer. I was great in practice, but it's when I went back to the room and we had those 3 hours in the afternoon to just sit around and lay around and just think.
And question yourself.
And question, exactly, Scotty, and question myself. You know, it's like, okay, wait a minute, this is the NFL. Okay, can I make it? Wait, I'm out there making plays. Yeah, I can make it. Oh, but you got Tom Jackson, Kenny Woodard in front of you. Can you make it? You know, and it's the sound of my own wheels that were making me crazy. And if I would have just been able to, here's the deal. if I would have had someone like me to talk to, just call him up and say, hey, you know what, Doc? Man, I'm asking myself all these questions. I'm going back and reflecting almost too much. You know, I could have helped regulated myself or helped regulate my clients the way I do now. I would have settled myself down, went back out to the second practice and just got after it. But conversely, I didn't. I did let the sound of my own wheels make me crazy. And really, that was, to me, kind of the demise of my NFL training camp, to be honest with you.
So you were listening to yourself instead of talking to yourself.
Yeah, well, not only that, but I was listening to those negative voices.
Well, that's what mostly drives most people. When I say you listen to somebody, usually it's the negative voices that has more strength.
Right, absolutely.
And it's being able to learn how to give the voice to that positive side of you and talk to that side.
Yeah, and the technical terms we use is we call that attentional focus, where you filter out the irrelevant cues and you focus on the relevant cues. And that's a major component of helping people regulate anxiety in their real life, filtering out irrelevant cues and focusing on the relevant cues. I mean, it feeds addiction. When we talk about anxiety in our society, it's because people are letting negative thoughts enter their mind and they're not able to filter them out. So it's the same in sport performance. We're allowing these negative thoughts, which are going to be there, by the way. The best in the world have negative thoughts. They're able to filter them out and really focus on only the relevant cues so they can perform at their peak level.
What about the psychology? And we're a part of this, too, this general sports psychology here in Denver, that we've spent 95% of our time engaged in relevant conversation about the Broncos during this offseason pertaining to one game. And taking 18 others that they played that counted, and basically shuffling them to the side. Even what Scott brought up earlier about the Matt Prater record-setting field goal, I had almost forgotten completely about that.
Right.
Individual achievement, team achievement.
Great
15
achievement.
Wins, 3 losses in their first 18 games, including playoffs last year, and yet 95% of our conversation, our examination, has been on the Super Bowl game. Isn't that doing what you're talking about?
Yes.
Letting negative thoughts become predominant in the general conversation in an inappropriate or an exaggerated way.
Sure.
It's not inappropriate, in an exaggerated manner.
Absolutely. You're allowing yourself to focus on the negative aspects of the season. If you look at the quantitative assessment of the Broncos, you know, they had a great record, right? 15-3. Great record. Look at the qualitative side. That's the aspects of how the high levels of they perform. Did they perform to their peak levels? Well, there's one game in which they didn't, okay? And that's what we take away from it. So that quantifiable loss they had in the Super Bowl is you know, really what we focus on, not the qualitative aspects that, you know what, that's a great team, great coaching staff, they're doing great things. But how do they carry that off into the offseason and the OTAs and focus on the positive? And I can tell you for a fact, I know that's been part of their foci. Foci is plural for focus, in case you're wondering, Scott.
I'm
in trouble with that one, too.
I thought you were telling me what I could go do to myself.
but that's got to be their main focal point going forward is, hey, you know what? We're right there. I mean, we had the most prolific quantitative offense in the history of the NFL. We've built the defense in the offseason. The key now is the task and the social cohesion that defense and that offense are going to play together with to take them to the highest levels. Because on paper, they look great. On paper, the coaching staff looks great. But you and I know that cohesion, how well they play together, how well they feed off each other from task and social, is really what's going to determine whether when they get hit in the mouth, okay, not when they get, if they get hit in the mouth,
it's
they're going to get hit in the mouth, right. And it may be in week 2, week 3, how are they going to respond to that? And that's the key right there.
Well, and it goes back to the comments from the one Seattle player that basically said they were scared.
Yep,
they played scared.
Yep, and listen to this, man. If an opposite player calls you out that way, that said you're scared, if I'm the Broncos, oh my gosh, that would piss me off beyond belief, especially coaches. Because here's the deal. You know, players are going to struggle in games. That's a given. Since the beginning of time. It's up to the coaches to regulate that arousal and anxiety so they can perform at peak levels. And here's the kicker for me. The NFL is a billion-dollar industry. Billion with a B. And 75% of the teams don't have full-time mental coaches on the team. And for me, that's astonishing. If you look at Ohio State, if you look at Florida State, if you look at Alabama, if you look at the top college programs, all of them have mental enhancement or mental conditioning coaches. And here we got teams in the NFL that are not employing these coaches. The Broncos have nutritionists. I think they have three nutritionists on staff, full-paid staff. They got weight training guys. They got core movement people. I mean, they have a plethora of experts. They have no full-time mental coach on staff. I'm not making a ploy for me.
Now, and every team has a shrink per league rules, but it's not by performance. It was when they were having too much domestic violence and other stuff like that.
Right.
They have that guy, and I don't even know if he's on staff or her, or if they, and even if they're in the building every single day, they have that available. But you're talking about from the performance side. Because you said a while ago, every athlete fails. And every athlete fails in every game.
Yep.
It's one thing to do it because physically you're tired at this moment or this, or you're just not strong enough, or you just take the wrong technique. It's another if you're allowing your head to cause you to fail.
I want to let you follow up because you touched on an interesting point. When we say Broncos got outcoached, let's say, at Super Bowl 48, what do we really mean by that? What should we mean by that if we're saying that in your estimation? We'll get into that a little bit more as well as other subjects with the good doctor, Dr. Rick Perea, on your home. The best live and local coverage, the Broncos, the NFL, Denver Sports Station, Sports Radio, 104.3 The Fan. There we go. We got some Eagles.
Documentary on the Eagles. There's a documentary on HBO or something like that just in the last year, because I watched it this past year sometime. The formation, how they started, you know, all the chicks and all the drugs early on, the breakups, losing this guitarist, kicking this one out. Yeah. But it was really a well-done documentary.
Sandy Clough, Scott Hastings, sitting in, of course, the good doctor, Dr. Rick Perea, professor of sports psychology, Metro State University of Colorado. Before we continue, we were talking about golf during the break. We've got our upcoming new fan golf tour event scheduled for Saddleback on Monday, July 28th, 9:15 a.m. Shotgun start. We have a foursome to give away. Golf and lunch at the Fans 2014 Fan Golf Tour event at Saddleback Golf Club in Firestone on Monday, July 28th. Caller number 5, 303-228-1043. Caller number 5. That's simple. You'll have a foursome for Saddleback on the 28th of July, which I believe is a week from Monday. So it's roughly 10 days away. Hope you're able to come out and join us. We were talking during the last segment, Dr. Perea, about not only something we've said, but many experts have contended since Super Bowl 48, that though the Broncos lost 43-8, a big part of the difference unfolded on the sidelines during the course of the game. The Bronco coaches got out-coached. What does that mean, or what should that mean if it is in fact true at all?
Yeah, I disagree with that postulation that they got out-coached. I don't think they got out-coached in terms of scheme, in terms of strategy, in terms of placing their personnel in the right, you know, specific situations, down and distance, tendencies, all that stuff. They didn't get out-coached. What happened, And we overlook this so much in sport. And again, you know, people probably say, of course, he's going to say that because he's a psychologist. But it's my job to look deeper, to be more analytical, to be more of a critical thinker. What happened is the Broncos mentally got beat. They didn't physically get beat. They got mentally beat first. And then that leads to getting beat physically, because then you start to believe those negative thoughts and you relax that much, and that's all it takes in the NFL. So here's my assertion of what really happened, and people perceive it as being outcoached, but it's really not being outcoached. It's that, you know, players during the flow of a game, the ebbs and flows of a game, you know, there's turnovers, there's long series, there's short series, there's block field goals, there's a lot of different ebbs and flows of a game. Players have to be able to mentally adjust and really regulate their arousal and anxiety so they can shift gears, filter out the irrelevant cues. Remember, we were just talking about those. filter those out, and move forward. So let's go back to the Super Bowl. The ball snapped over Peyton's head.
Right.
Goes through the end zone. There's a safety. So here you go. We're a few seconds into the game. Broncos are punting the ball away on defense. So you look over at the Broncos sideline, and you look at the players in their eyes. And you can see non-verbally, it's like a deer staring in the headlights. And I can
literally.
And I can tell you this. There are many coaches that I've talked to. When I went through my California swing, I met with some of my clients. And to a coach, these are other NFL coaches, said, that game wasn't lost physically. It was mentally. And so what it is that those players need to be regulated between series. And so what that means is there's very simple protocols that we take them through. We, you know, in our organization, we coach coaches. And some coaches we work with, when we get in there, they're like, man, we thought you were going to tell us how to coach. And I'm like, no, we don't tell coaches how to coach. We coach coaches to learn how to coach process versus outcome. Let me give you an example. So instead of a coach going back to the sidelines and saying to his offensive line, hey, man, we got to block their five technique. We got to block number 75. That's what most coaches do, okay? What they should be saying is, okay, guys, we've got to block number five, and let's get back to our practices and protocols. Keep your hips underneath you. Remember your feet, hand placement, explode with your hips, follow through. That will take a player focusing on the relevant cues, remember? And then everything else is irrelevant. They stop thinking about the snap. They stop thinking about the score because those are irrelevant cues. And they focus on the relevant cues of the technique that it takes to block number 75. But too many coaches oversimplify, and they'll just come back and say,
Hit him harder.
We got to get more rebounds. Okay, but if I say, and you know this, Scott, if I go into a huddle, a timeout, and I say, we got to get more rebounds, and 12 players are hearing me say that, I have 12 different interpretations of what that means. Yes.
Because you know what happened? Listen, and I've told this story before. I had a routine when I shot free throws.
Absolutely.
And I didn't think of the score or the time or the position of the game. I went back to my routine. That's all I would try to concentrate on. What you're talking about is that. So now all of a sudden, and there were deer on the headlights. We've seen the video. We've seen the comments. I've talked to people. Nothing was said. That instead of aggravating it or even intensifying that stress, if you will, that anxiety, you get back and go, hey, no, we got to hit this guy, but remember what we're doing. Got to get our butts low. We got to make sure we're synced. Don't make sure you're not stepping back too fast. Wait for him to come. Get a hold of him. And you get back to teaching,
right?
And now you're not focused on the game. That's what you're saying, right?
Yes, absolutely. Those are the relevant cues. And if you get back to teaching technique, which is, again, process, Nick Saban, process of the game, coaches will get the player's head back to where it needs to be and away from all the tertiary things like score, all the other, you know, the shock of, oh, my gosh, that went over his head. They focus on what's relevant. And, again, take the subjectivity out of it by telling them exactly what you want them to do, and it focuses them back on it. Now, all that has to do, all that needs to be done is a mental coach takes 20 seconds and will tell an offensive line, we're okay, guys. We're okay. Let's go back to our protocols. Let's go back to what we practiced during the week. Like you said, sink your hips, keep your hips underneath you, explode. And that gets players back focused on what they should be thinking about instead of all those irrelevant cues.
We touched on this at the top, and you've addressed it a little bit already, but you've made the point before that Mark Richt, the Georgia coach, was with you in that Bronco camp
back
31 years ago in 1983, and he's talked a lot about the mental side of the game.
Yes.
He appreciates that. A lot of the SEC coaches,
they do.
As a matter of fact,
understand
that.
Isn't that funny? Shouldn't that mean something?
Yeah, it just the SEC coaches just it's important. Yes, and you've talked about how the NFL needs more than the college game, generally speaking, to get on board with some of these principles. But you say we need to start with the idea of not referring to sport or sports psychology and talk more in terms of enhancement, conditioning, performance enhancement.
Yes, because those two words, sports psychology, for a lot of coaches, puts them on alert. It makes them
they turn tail and run.
Yeah.
Figuratively speaking.
Oh my gosh. They're going to come in here and analyze us. They're going to come in here and ask us me about my childhood. You know,
they're going to make us soft. Most coaches and most players think that psychology means you're soft.
Right. And that's not at all of what we do. What we do is we enhance the mental piece so they can perform better. Again, focusing on relevant cues, emphasizing positive self-talk, talking about all the different aspects of mental thought process and how that makes you perform at peak levels. You know, you mentioned Mark Richt. You know, he's the head coach at Georgia.
Yeah.
In that training camp in 1983, you had Mark Richt, John Elway, Gary Kubiak, a lot of cerebral guys in that camp. And it's interesting how they've spawned out and they've actually made good head coaches. And Scott, you mentioned about imagine the SEC having a lot of guys believing in the mental side. You know, we talk about the SEC being high performing. And we always associate it with great athletes. And it is. That's part of it. But it's also that those coaches down there know they have to keep up with one guy down there. And that's Nick Saban. And so they know, man, if this guy's bringing in the mental aspect, then we need to bring it in. And so my assertion, getting back to the NFL, Sandy, is that I have found in my work with NFL coaches and my work with college coaches that there's more of a close fraternity of coaches in the NFL that are saying, nah, it's just football. It's just football. But if they understood exactly what we do, it's not the psychological soft piece Scotty's talking about. It's just mental enhancement, having people figure out and regulate themselves so they can deploy their true physiological self.
More, including some of your text questions for Dr. Rick Perea up ahead. Sandy Clough, Scott Hastings, Dr. Rick Perea in studio. On your home for the best live and local coverage, the Broncos and the NFL, Denver Sports Station, Sports Radio 104.3 The Fan.
We'll fight till it's over, so we put our hands up like the ceiling can't hold us. Like the ceiling can't hold us.
Here we go back. It is 2:32. Drew, Sandy, Scott. Sandy Clough, Scott Hastings, Dr. Rick Perea.
Hey, Doc.
In studio.
Doc, by the way, I'm back in the way. Got back in the way.
Really? You're looking good, bud.
Thank you, man.
I like those tries.
You can tell, can't you, Doc?
Yeah. You know, tries for the guys, buys for the gals, man. You know.
Tries for the guys.
Tries for the guys.
Couple of questions. Total Beverage Text Line 29588. I like this one from the 720. Dr. Perea, is there a possible cognitive disconnect between the nasty physical nature the defense is trying to have with the Broncos and the perfection and precision that Peyton Manning demands of the offense as well as from the whole team?
Oh, I love that question.
Great question.
It's a great question. Yeah, I've often thought about that. You know, we on defense, you think about whether you're a single gap or a two gap player on defense, you are really reacting to what the offense is doing. You have a play call, you have a gap responsibility, and you have a coverage call and all those things. But you're still reacting to what the offense is doing. And so when we've done research on this, it takes about 13% more energy to play defense than it does offense.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, which is theoretical. You got to rest your defense. And that goes back to the run game, but that's a whole other story for another day.
That we all agree on.
Yeah, absolutely. You got to rest your defense. They got to be, you know, fresh and ready to go. But on defense, you do have to have that nasty, that intensity, that sometimes that personality aspect that you can't coach. You know, Sandy, I've talked a lot on this show about personality assessments. And one of the biggest things that I tell the NFL coaches I work with is these personality assessments will give us a window into their true covert behaviors. Covert means we don't see them. There are some guys that act nasty. There's some guys that pretend to be nasty. But I'm talking about the guys that will fight you all day long and then come up to you after the game and say, hey, man, let's meet in the parking lot. I'll do this anywhere, any place you want to do. There's not a lot of guys like that. There's really not. And when you get a few of them on your team, man, you've got to cultivate that and bring that along because that really is that nasty piece that will develop you. Now, Peyton is really precision-oriented. That offense is precision-oriented. But really, most football teams are separate in that way. The offensive coordinator has his climate and culture. The defensive coordinator has their climate and culture. But I'll tell you what, Gase has a pretty interesting climate and culture too. You know, I've been around him myself a little bit, and he's got a dynamic personality. He's not one of these guys that just sits there.
He's not a technocrat, just cerebrally analyzing.
No, absolutely, man.
He's the guy that might fight you in the parking lot after the game.
He'll fight you in the parking lot, and he'll walk over to the defense during practice and say, hey, we're going to wear you out today. You know, he'll talk a little smack, get a little excited, and so that aspect I think bodes well.
I was reading this book quickly, Scott. I don't mean to interrupt, but on Lombardi and Landry,
yeah,
when they were assistant coaches together with the Giants, and Jim Lee Howe at the time was the head coach, and he was the first of the CEO head coaches. Reminded me a lot of the Bronco situation.
Yeah.
Some of the personalities are a little different, but
yeah,
one of the Foxes, CEO head coach, and he's got two rather dynamic, strong personalities as coordinators, and to Fox's credit, he lets them do what they do. But I remember reading the book, there's the tie, and everybody knows what Lombardi's style was like.
Right.
Lombardi was the offensive coordinator.
Right.
And yet he was constantly talking to the defense, because
sure,
the defense used to trash talk the offense back
right
in those great Giant teams,
right,
because the defense was better than the offense, and it grated at Lombardi.
Yep.
Lombardi would yell at the defense,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, and that,
so, and that dynamic was healthy for the Giants.
Absolutely.
Not destructive.
No, absolutely. And so the caller's original question is really good, because it's astute, because he's really asserting that can that aggressiveness, that dynamic nastiness of the defense, of what you hope to cultivate on a very aggressive, assertive defense, you know, combat any way an offense that is really technically scheme oriented. It would if their climate and culture were run by the same coach, but they're not. They're different. You know, offensive coordinators, people must understand, offensive coordinators develop game plans from the get-go. The coach, the head coach, oversees it. The defensive coordinator, establishes the game plan the whole way through the week, and the head coach has to oversee it. But those guys have their own climate and culture within a team that really cultivates some of that task cohesion and social cohesion as well. And what I see with the Broncos, if they're able to stay healthy, to me, that's the big question this year, especially on defense. If they're able to stay healthy, then I think they're going to have a real chance to perform at their peak levels, because they have personnel, they have the offensive defensive coordinator in place, and they have, you know, the schemes and everything to execute it. The key is if they can stay healthy in their one technique and their three technique. That's their nose or their defensive tackle. If they can stay healthy in those two positions, then they really have a chance.
The one thing from Sandy's story to what you're talking about, and I think, you know, you look at Adam Gase and Jack Del Rio and John Fox, three different personalities. Landry, it was as calm,
absolutely,
on the surface as Lombardi seemed to be, as mm-hmm, demonstrative. I mean, almost be polar
opposite.
Well, they
call Lombardi Mr. High-Low. In fact, Landry put that nickname on, Mr. High-Low. There was nothing
right
in between.
But both those two guys had success in the ultimate way as far as a team sport in the NFL.
Right.
They both won championships.
Of course.
Which reminds me of the golf swing. You have these guys looping it up here, this guy's bringing it low here, and this guy's bringing it here. There's been guys with all those kind of swings,
yep,
have won a championship. The point that I think we all kind of missed, because we look at all the periphery stuff, we look at the loud and obnoxious and the quiet and tied up, that when they get to striking the ball, when they get down right here, I bet you there's a whole bunch of similarities.
Absolutely. Yeah, and that's the thing I was trying to get across for Gase and Del Rio, is that they get it done in their own ways and they establish different climate and cultures. But I'll tell you what, they stay awake at night thinking of ways they're going to get better. And that's what you got to love about this coaching staff. You know, Gase just had the most prolific offense in the history of the NFL, and here he is saying, how do I get better? How do I get better? There'll be a lot of coaches be like, okay, we're pretty much set. You know, we'll come back to training camp. We'll get reps. We'll get
play,
you know,
better this year.
We'll play. You know, but here's a guy that's searching for ways to get better, and you got to love that.
When you look at Manning specifically, is the idea that you ask him to do less, or do you strengthen what's around him? And can you do that without taking away the considerable authority he has, and by all indication should have, within the team?
Yeah, I think absolutely you do take a little bit away from him, because that leadership that he's deploying is, believe it or not, it's stressful on him. Now, let's go back to my psychological background. He's a natural leader. He's very good at deploying it verbally and vocally, but it still adds some stress to him. I would want his number one job to be scheme. Okay, you go back there, sit on the sidelines, look at the Polaroids. Okay, they're in a cover two, but they're disguising it as a three. We need, you know, let's put pressure on the edge. Think of how they're going to attack the defense. That's his number one thing. Not necessarily leading everybody else, because that is stressful on him. The other thing about deploying some of that leadership to other players on the offensive side of the ball is you have a more eclectic group, a diverse group where other players are able to assert their leadership. You know, Demaryius Thomas, I think, is someone that should start to lead a little bit more verbally. He's obviously proves it on the field, on the offensive side of the ball. But he's the guy that the Broncos could look to. Vasquez is an offensive lineman.
Absolutely. What a great player he is.
He's a great player, but he could lead a little bit better. To take away some of that leadership deployment from Peyton, because he can do it. There's no question. But I think when it comes to a smash-mouth game, you know, they're going to play Seattle again. They're going to play the 49ers, and they're going to line up in a power formation, and Del Rio knows they're coming, and they're going to say, stop us if you can. And it's going to be a game possession type thing. Denver needs to be able to do that with them, and part of that takes leadership from other positions to step on the sidelines and say, hey, let's go, fellas. Let's get our butts going and not rely on 18 all the time to be that leader.
But what that means then is you've got to find a way as a coaching staff, and as you talked about with Adam, and I think he is trying to do that. You mentioned other names, Vasquez, Demaryius Thomas. It's an empowering those other guys, or those other guys feeling empowered that when they step up, and I always said this, you've got to be able, I'll go back to Isaiah Thomas, and one of the greatest leaders I ever played for. But if he got out of line or did something wrong, there was Vinnie Johnson or Mark Aguirre or Bill Laimbeer or Dennis Rodman would say, no, you're wrong.
Yes.
And they weren't afraid to challenge him. Now, we still knew he was the ultimate dog.
Yep.
But they felt empowered enough to say, no, dude, you're doing this wrong, man. You got to come. He gets so emotional and so mad. There was times guys said, dude, Zeke, you need to settle down.
Yeah. And what you're saying, Scotty, gets me so excited. I swear I wish I had a whiteboard in here so I could display it. What you're talking about is that task cohesion. And that builds that social cohesion. That's exactly what we look for in organizations to perform at peak levels, is task and social cohesion. You need other players to be able to say, hey, I have a say in this team. I would make this assertion. Denver didn't win the Super Bowl because they weren't a complete, eclectic team led by different leaders. They were led by one primary CEO-type guy on the field, but now they're, if you look at them like as Apple or Microsoft, they need the director of marketing to step up. They need the sales managers to step up to make this team more divergent and eclectic in its approach of leadership. And once they do that,
which makes them more powerful.
It makes them more powerful, not only verbally and vocally, but on the field as well when they try to control the clock.
Fascinating. As always, with Dr. Rick Perea, we have another quarter hour just ahead. More of your texts, along with some final thoughts, as we're less than a week away from the opening of Training Camp 2014 out at Dove Valley. Sandy Clef, Scott Hastings, Dr. Rick Perea in studio on your home for the best live and local coverage of the Broncos and the NFL. Sports Radio, 104.3 The Fan, Denver Sports. Few final thoughts with Dr. Rick Perea, Sandy Clef, Scott Hastings in studio at 303-228-1043 on the phones.
We ought to get a
295-882
a film crew every time he's in here because the stuff during the break.
Oh, it's great.
And then if we get a film crew ever in here, we'll bring the dry erase board.
There you go.
This year, home for the best live and local coverage, the Broncos and the NFL, Denver Sports Station, Sports Radio 104.3 The Fan. It's a little bit off the topic that we've been talking about generally over the last 45 minutes, but a good question, I think, from 405. Please ask the doctor if he thinks that no huddle offenses lead to additional stress, maybe more injuries. What do you think, doctor, of the 10-second rule in college football? Would that help? That was something that your friend Nick Saban was advocating, at least for a while.
Yeah.
During the course of this offseason.
Yeah, great question. The no-huddle offense and the spread offense have changed the way that we play defense. You know, we talk about gap defense, gap responsibility, single and double gap responsibility. But when you get spread out as a defense, you know, the pack is now spread out. The offense is specifically trying to spread you out. And so it does change the way we play. The 10-second, that all changes the way defense are able to deploy their players in terms of coverages, in terms of gap responsibility. You know, when you used to play against just single, you know, eye formation, power eye formation, pro set formation, you know, you could bring your defense and the pack was playing together. Everybody was together. We had our gap responsibility. It was more of about 3 yards and a cloud of dust. Whereas now the defense is spread out and we have to have players which play in space much more effectively. Linebackers have to have very free hips now. In fact, the Mike linebacker is almost non-existent as we knew it before because linebackers have to be able to transition quickly into pass coverage, come up and support the run, and that takes a lot more athleticism than it used to require. So to answer the caller, yeah, the spread offense, no huddle offense has really changed the way that we are able to deploy ourselves defensively, and that wasn't by accident.
Yeah, it puts more pressure, and then it goes back to if it's 13%, how does that increase? 13% harder to play defense and offense, does that even increase it now with the no huddles and the quick, which is what the Broncos try to do.
Absolutely.
They want more stress on the defense.
Yes. Yeah. That's why Gase is over there saying we're going to wear you out today. Because
that's
what they're going to
do. We're going to play faster even than we did last year when we scored 606 points.
Absolutely.
A couple of questions from the 720, endorsing your point earlier. Doc, you're so right. We don't have a Romanowski or even an Atwater on this team. Well, maybe they now do if it's Ward. If it's Aqib Talib.
Yeah, you know, you'd love that nasty to come from your front seven. Again, if T.J. Ward's got it and he brings it from the strong safety position, that's great. You'd love to have it in that front seven, though, because that's where it starts. I'm telling you, man, you know, we talk about spread offenses. We talk about throwing the ball around the yard. But if you can't stop the run, teams will still run it on you. Don't mistake that. They will run it on you. And stopping the run starts at the one technique, the three and the five, and those inside backers. But I'm telling you, man, if you cannot bring some of that nasty and you have some of those players that will just fight with no reward in sight, I'm talking about the guys that just love getting down in there and fighting, it's a hard road to hoe. It really is, because in the NFL, you know, we're rewarding these players with extrinsic rewards, and that's money. And the research shows very clearly that when you reward players with money, it tends to motivate them. You can still be creative and motivate them in other ways, but you've got to be really specific in the way you do that. And we do that through coaching the process.
That's interesting to me to hear, because if it's just about the money, I guess it doesn't matter what motivates you.
Right.
You know, if it's to make more money, then you're going to play better. You're going to be in better shape. You're going to be more cohesive. In basketball, it's different when you talk about that, because guys going for more money, they don't care what the team does. They just want to look at their numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And that I think is completely opposite of what San Antonio does and what the good teams do to
win
championships. So that's a fine line for that guy that's just about the money, or the guy that's out there for this performance, wants to be paid for his performance, but it's still about the team. And that's a tough line some guys walk.
Right.
Or don't walk.
Right, exactly. But, you know, the research is really clear. And I know there's pundits out there who say, oh, research. But, you know, we do this research on real players. And it's really clear that extrinsic motivation, it'll motivate somebody, like you say, Scotty, for a season until they get their new contract. But intrinsic motivation that lasts over time is really done because players love the game. They love the camaraderie of the game. They love that feeling of hitting somebody. I mean, I remember when I used to play, I mean, you can taste hitting. You can taste it. And if you love it from that aspect, that's going to motivate you intrinsically. And then going back, though, the way that we assess this, because I heard you say earlier in the day, Sandy, that how you assess quarterbacks, we've got to get back to those personality assessments. We've really got, because that gives us that window into people's covert personality. I can walk into an office and act tough, but I'm really not. I can walk into a meeting and act like I'm a badass, but I'm really not. These personality assessments really give us a window into who these people really are. And if more NFL executives would rely on this, not only, but as a tool in the overall mechanism, they would make much better, astute choices in their draft choices.
People have asked me, I was talking to a soccer coach years and years ago, and I've made a living being an analyst, so to speak. And we were talking about this and about sport, and he goes, so you're telling me you can sit there and watch a soccer game and tell me, you know, who's a good athlete, who's not? And I went, yeah.
Yep, yeah. Absolutely.
I don't think it's very hard.
Absolutely.
Can you do the same thing emotionally or mentally and meet a guy or talk to a guy or watch them interact with people and say, capable, not capable, is a leader, could be a leader, not a leader yet? Or can you
absolutely
see that?
I did it at the combine this year. I sat down and across from players and look at them. Nonverbal communication is 80% more reliable than verbal communication.
Wow.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, because we can't fake nonverbal. People blinking eyes, looking down and up, not making direct eye contact, leaning back. fiddling with their thumbs, scratching their head when their head doesn't itch. Okay. Right. There's reasons why we do these things. And so psychologically, yes, we can really make assessments of people non-verbally as well as verbally. It's so important to get to know somebody. When you bring in these players, the teams that I work with, I go pick them up at the airport because I want to see how they talk to the baggage people. I want to see how they talk to the parking attendants, how they talk to me. Do they make eye contact with me? Do they look at every girl walking by? I mean, I need to know these things because it's going to be part of my assessment that feeds into. It's my qualitative side into the quantitative side of the assessment that I give them. Very important piece, Scotty.
Wow.
The question came across in the text line, too, about what we were talking about before with coaching and what happens during a game when things start going wrong. If John Fox or somebody in authority had tried some humor, cracked a joke, could that have had any effect or not really so
much? You mean in the Super Bowl?
Yeah, at some point.
No, because
would humor have countered what was going on.
I would
on,
say yes if they followed up with what you said a while ago by the instruction. Break the ice, calm, relax everybody down, but then say now,
like
boys.
After the safety, was there any room for humor in reaction to that?
Here's the key. If it's his modus operandi, if that's who he is, if he's that way during the week, then yeah, that'll work for him in game time. If he's that way and that's his personality, then yeah. I remember looking at coaches who were very good at saying, guys, come on, man. This is just football. Let's break this down. And then there's other coaches that you look them in the face and they had more anxiety than we did.
Right.
So you wouldn't even want to look at them, you know? And again, I won't mention names, but there's a lot of guys out there coaching in the NFL making millions of dollars who have high levels of anxiety. And I'll guarantee you their players are looking at them nonverbally and feeding off that anxiety.
I think some of that happened in the Super Bowl.
Oh, you betcha, baby. You betcha. And you know what? Here's the key. That's all right that it happened. Let's get better. That's the key. Face the music and go, how do we get better at that? That's what I love about some of these organizations. IBM does it. Apple does it. The top corporations in the world bring outside people in to hold them accountable. The NFL teams need to start doing this more on a regular basis because there are the tools and there is the expertise to help them perform at peak levels.
We've been talking about the NFL for 55 minutes, but before we reach the
football
top of the
Friday.
Hour, let you go. It is Football Friday, but one of our texters asked a question. I have to get your reaction to it, and we haven't talked about this off the air either. Can the good doctor try to describe, based on Dick Monfort's recent comments, the strengths and weaknesses he sees in Monfort as an organizational leader? I think he's specifically referring to the back and forth on emails with various fans.
Yes, my assertion would be that he was part of a successful organization in the meatpacking business. My understanding is that is a generational business and he was raised into it.
Yes.
Doesn't necessarily mean that his competency and acumen in that business can translate. I would even make the assertion that he may not have even been competent in that business. We would never know. He could have been sheltered in that business, and he never could have been one that was making the decision. So it's very possible that he really wasn't astute in that business. So when he came into this business, he didn't have the tools, the skill, and the knowledge to be able to take this organization to a higher level. Because I'll tell you what. Climate and culture are everything to organization's performance, and his willingness to stand and watch this team implode from the inside out year after year says something to me as an organizational leader.
When he says, by bringing a new guy in here, it would change the entire culture, to me, he leads by fear.
Yeah.
Or through fear.
Absolutely. But last comment I want to get in, let's go back to fashion. Kaufman, I know Sam. I'm wearing orange socks with green shoes. Does that work for you, man?
I thought you looked cool. I loved your shorts, but the shoes are awesome. See, and I I'm always going to match. A little bit here. Although I did bring, I got a little camel.
I don't know.
I got black shoes, black shorts on.
You know, Sandy, Scotty's my haberdasher, So I have to ask him if it's working. So
no,
I had to get that in.
No, that's not working.
The Sultan of Haberdashery, all right.
I will just say this. Be confident in your age.
That's
baby.
We will reconvene on Monday afternoon starting at noon. It will be our first football week of 2014/15. We look forward to it. Hope you join us then on your home for the best live and local coverage of the Broncos, the NFL, Denver Sports Station, Sports Radio, 104.3 The Fan.